96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. Now, Insight.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Another deadly school shooting. 10 people killed at a high school in Texas this morning. Here in the district, a 15-year-old Ballou High School student, Jalen Wheeler, killed this week outside of a school, and dozens of students from rival schools in a huge fight this week in the district. Why are our schools seeing so many violent incidents? How do we talk about this? What can we do about it? We are talking about it tonight. My guests are clinical psychologist Dr. Jeff Menzi and Elizabeth Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union. Later in the program, we will hear from D.C.'s Ward 8 council member Trayon White. Lines are open if you have a comment or a question about school violence nationally or locally. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Elizabeth Davis and Dr. Jeff Menzi, thank you both for joining the conversation.
Thank you for the invitation.
Dr. Menzi, let me start with you. 17-year-old, now charged with capital murder, the suspect in shooting 20 and killing 10. It just seems that we are constantly seeing this issue regarding young people. What's happening?
Well, I mean, if you notice, Harold, it's a certain demographic, man. You fit a certain description almost every time, brother. And so it's not all kids that are dealing with this stuff. I mean, all kids are equally victimized, but it's not all kids that are perpetuating this crime. What I'm noticing is a very similar profile. They go back on, they find their social media, they see they posted pictures with guns, they see they posted statements about being killers or being violent, and it's not until after the fact that they make a move and start trying to do something about it. But if they lay dollars short, man, we got people dead by this point.
In this particular case, the suspect in Texas did not, so far, based on what police are saying and the FBI is saying, that he did not have a lot of warning signs. He had no run-ins with law enforcement. He did not have any suspicious postings. But instead, what we've seen, based on what the FBI and the local police are reporting, not just the shooting itself, but something more severe, pipe bombs and pressure cooker bombs, the likes of which we've not seen since the Boston Marathon attack.
Right, but see, Harold, they did find an image. It said he had a T-shirt posted that said "Born to Kill."
And how many? And how many T-shirts? Okay, you see a T-shirt like that.
Yep.
Is that really going to raise a question about somebody?
Well, it would with me. Just understanding the times that we're living in right now, and how with my background in clinical psychology, every sign is a true sign to be looked into. And so, with today's climate, with coaches in the boat, and young kids giving indications like posting T-shirts, posting guns, you know, having certain personality traits and dispositions, I would absolutely take it serious. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to run into a situation where people are going to start being over-policed, you know, and I would say, welcome to the black experience. As we're noticing, a lot of black people are being over-policed right now, and it's just that the young white kids who are actually have the most potential for being violent like this are the ones being overlooked and should be the ones being looked at.
Let's talk a little bit about what we've seen just here in the district regarding our schools, Elizabeth Davis. We've had this.
Thank you. I do agree with Dr. Lindsay. You know, we both know that for black and brown youth, the debate around school safety and gun control is nothing new because they've been at the forefront of these debates for decades. When black and brown youth go to school, they see guns. They know they are more likely to be used against them than to protect them. And they are dehumanized by dogs sniffing their backpacks, harassed by police through invasive body searches and metal detectors, stripped of their privacy with their lockers being searched. So this is their current reality. And in the school environment that treats some youth fairly treats many black and brown youth as suspects and criminals. Now, you pointed out some of the issues that police did not see in the and the individual that did the shooting in Texas. A lot of the characteristics would not be seen readily by a police officer, but by individuals who are trained to detect that. A lot of them which have been stripped from schools due to the defunding of public schools, social workers, counselors, and other individuals that can cite problems before they happen. And in many cases, teachers may not be trained to do that. But the people who provide specialized services for students can, in many cases, detect problems that students are having, and it doesn't always show up on a police record, because in many cases, some of these students did not have police records. There are a number of issues here.
But hold on, because I think you make an excellent point, but specifically here in the district, we just lost a 15-year-old young man, Jalen Wheeler, just this week. He had only been at Ballou for a week. We've had this incident at Somerset Prep Academy, where there was a huge fight. We've had reports of dozens of students from Ballou invading, for lack of a better term, Somerset. We had the incident outside of the IDEA school a week or so ago. How do you protect students and teachers without more policing?
Well, and of course, today, Harold, more than 20 black and brown youth organizations published a petition to address that. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that they raised was there need to be the divestment from school policing, basically because school policing has targeted black and brown youth. Comprehensive mental and emotional health services that many of our youth need. Our schools are being defunded and stripped of those services, and guidance counselors, social workers, the expansion of restorative justice practices, culturally responsive education, and investments in schools and teachers and the service providers that help. Those things are being defunded, are being basically stripped from schools, especially in the poorest communities that need those services. And we need to draw the correlation between what is happening in schools in poor communities, where protection for students and families basically does not look the same way as it would in a wealthy white community. Mm. So there needs to be a concrete plan to end gun violence and all of that. But there are several problems that are factored into this. And one of them has to do with, and even though black and brown youth are standing with those students from Florida and all over the nation against gun violence, but there are still other issues that impact black and brown youth. When you think about what led to Black Lives Matter, these are issues that black youth have been facing for decades.
But hold on for 1 second, because I do need to go to the phones, and I do have some other points that I think we need to make in this conversation. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about violence in and around our schools, not only here in the district, but also what we've seen today in southeastern Texas, and obviously what we saw earlier this year in Parkland, Florida. What's going on? How do we protect our schools? How do we protect teachers and students? Let's go to Antoinette, calling from Virginia. What's on your mind, Antoinette?
Hello.
Hi.
First of all, we have to put prayer back in schools. And back when my daughter was growing up, I showed up at school. I wanted to know what she was doing. But now it's hard for the parents to come to the school. We have to make appointments. We have to figure out, send emails. But kids can just walk into school and do whatever they want to. And we as parents have to get involved to find out what our children are doing, what they're listening to, who they're hanging with. We just have to get back as being parents.
Yeah, well, you just, okay, let me make sure I'm clear. You said we need prayer in schools, but so just prayer in schools, but no prayer at home?
Everything starts at home.
Okay, because if you're praying at home, do you need prayer in school?
Yes, we need prayer everywhere.
So you think that prayer in school is the answer to the kind of violence?
Not the answer.
Okay, so what do you say?
To put prayer back, we have to have God in the midst. God has to be in the midst, and putting prayer back where it's been taken out of, we just have to start somewhere, and prayer would help. Prayer helps.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about violence in our schools, not just here in the district, but nationally. How do we address it? And how do we talk to our children about it? I want to go back to this point, and I want both of you to briefly talk a little bit about this. And Elizabeth Davis, I'll start with you. This incident between these Ballou students and the Somerset Prep Academy, what role do you believe mental health services or funding these kinds of support issues will help when we have some 20 or 30 kids deciding to go to another school to attack? That I'm not sure I understand how that may help. I mean, and I say I just don't know. Your thoughts about that, Elizabeth?
Are you addressing me, Harold?
Yes,
or Dr.
yes.
Lincoln?
Yes, you first, please.
Okay. And of course, I'm going to go back to the divestment that is happening from public school. And, of course, the policing of our schools is not the cure. Mm-hmm. And I do, as a teacher of 40 years, with at least 30 of my years in Ward 7 and 8 schools, I do know that a lot of these services and support services for teachers and students are not readily available, including access for parents to come into schools to engage with teachers and students. Now, in this case, as the parent that just called in said, we have students who are able to walk into a school, but parents cannot engage with their students. And access, in many cases, is based on race and class. Mm. And that's just the reality. Mm.
Doctor?
Yeah, it's a sticky situation. I think that what we have to observe in like at Ballou and some of the other local incidents, they are totally different. I mean, they're violent incidents, but they are different, you know, than what we're talking about took place in Texas.
Right.
As far as the accessibility to services, I served as a school psychologist with DC Public Schools, you know, for quite a few years, about 5 years. And it's never enough. You know what I mean? It's never enough preventative efforts being put forward. It's always seeming like we're putting out fires. And so it's going to require us to kind of take another look at how we approach mental health, not only in the school systems, man, but also in the community. Like you said, it's not only necessary to have prayer at school, but what's taking place at home. And so our children are coming from stressed out and sometimes dangerous situations into our school. And they don't have a place to vent or release that frustration. And so it gets channeled and directed at whoever it is that ticks them off that day. And that's
what we end up doing, Dr. Lindsay, like you said, is addressing the symptom and not the problem. The symptom is having 30 to 40 students who are out of school in the middle of the school day and able to walk into another school. That is a symptom of a problem. The question is, why are they out of their own school? What resources are available in their schools? When we look at attendance at Ballou and other schools, we need to look at that as a symptom of a greater problem. What is offered for schools? What is there to engage them? Are the support services they need in place? The
yeah, them walking into another school, they weren't looking for services going to another. They didn't go to another school looking for services. They went to another school to do exactly what they
did
when they got
there.
Why
were they out of their own school?
And so I don't see having more services in the school as a potential remedy for the kids that ran up into another school.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a far greater issue than increasing service in schools.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about violence in our school, and it's sometimes deadly violence. How do we address this, not only locally, but nationally? I need to take a break. Before I do, Elizabeth Davis, can you stay on a few moments after 7:30 to continue this conversation?
Absolutely. Sure.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And we are efforting our phone call with Ward 8 Council Member Trayon White. Hopefully we will be able to contact him as well. If you are on the phone, please stay with us. You will be able to hear the program. That includes Kendall calling from Fort Washington. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR. More of this conversation on violence in our schools in just a moment.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3, student-run WHBC, HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU, and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about violence in our schools, locally and nationally. Why are we seeing so much of it? My guests are clinical psychologist Dr. Jeff Minzi, as well as Elizabeth Davis. She is president of the Washington Teachers Union. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you're having difficulty getting through, please keep trying. I promise we will take your call. Kendall, calling from Fort Washington. Briefly, what's on your mind? Go right ahead. Kendall,
yes.
Go ahead.
How you doing? Thanks for having me on here.
Sure.
Two things.
Real quick.
Number one, we need to refund the federal mental institution. It was defunded under Reagan. The mass shootings started increasing after that. Number two, these shootings need to be reclassified as domestic terrorism. As simple as that. Okay.
Which ones?
The Waffle House, up until now, anything that terrorizes the citizens of the United States, no matter who they are, master, it should be marked as domestic terrorism.
Okay. Kendall, thank you so much. Dr. Minzi, your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so the issue with that is that the definition for terror is very specific, and they're able to and say necessarily fit the official definition of it. But I do agree that these need to be labeled as such because they are terrorist acts. If it was a person wearing a hijab with a sister with her head covered or a Muslim brother, and he screamed out a lot, then it was a hate crime, you see, or a act of terrorism. And so, and I think it's the exact same situation we're looking at here, except the person is not fitting the stereotypical descriptions anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was...
I think we're having some difficulty with your phone call. I'm sure our producer will work on it. Let me go to Vernon. Vernon on the line. Thanks for calling, Vernon. What's on your mind? Vernon, can you hear me?
Yeah, with not only our schools, but in our truth is that the teachers have gone out of the nation and that our leaders are talking out of the sides of their mouths. And they're being very deceptive. And the young people are seeing these things and they're reacting to it.
Vernon, I'm sorry. I heard a little bit about leadership. Your call was not clear. Maybe you can give us another call back if you're calling on a cell phone. Elizabeth, I'd like to have you respond to the statement that came from the D.C. public school system today. This was in reference to the killing of Jason Wheeler. And I quote, "We are deeply troubled by the loss of Jalen and extend our deepest condolences to the Wheeler family." But then it goes on to say, "DCPS has taken measures to increase supervision, safety, and social emotional supports for our students." Ballou received support from the D.C. Public Schools Crisis Response Team, a team made up of professionals trained to help with the needs of students, parents, and staff during difficult times such as this. Social workers, counselors, and school psychologists were also available to offer students space and time to talk and share their feelings. That is what the D.C. Public Schools says happened in the aftermath of this. But you were talking about how to address this on the front end. Your thoughts about that, and specifically, how would those issues be dealt with? What would they look like on the front end?
And I'm glad, because that response from D.C. Public Schools is basically a Band-Aid approach. And, of course, it is a service that is certainly needed after a crisis such as that. However, we're talking about intervention. We're talking about providing comprehensive mental and emotional health services to children, to youth, before incidents like that occur. We're talking about ensuring that every school, and of course, in spite of, and I heard Dr. Lindsay say that the resources available to students may not matter. I disagree. We've talked about various levels of violence here, And I do not believe that some of the issues that we're talking about can be escalated to the level as to rate students as terrorists. No, I do not agree with that. However, when we talk about what is what's available to students at Ballou High School and at the charter school and other schools in some of the areas that are underfunded and under-resourced, when we compare those to schools that have adequate funding and resources and staff and wraparound support services for students and supports for teachers, there is a difference. There's a disparity. And if we don't acknowledge that, we will continue to apologize and express condolences to parents who lose their children without addressing the deeper problem. And we need to take a look at what are the resources available at Ballou? Are the students at Ballou, do they have access to the same learning opportunities as students at Wilson or School Without Walls or Banneker? And we've got to be honest about that. I happen to know that many of the course offerings, the teachers that are available, counselors, and these times, we cannot use a ratio of one counselor to 400 or 500 students, given all that we're dealing with right now in this country.
I've got this Facebook reach out specifically for you, Elizabeth Davis. This comes from Rosetta, and she's asking, how do we get our children to want to stay in school with a possible greater going to prison, she was writing quickly. I think what she's saying is, how do we instill hope in our hopeless youth? How do we get them to stay in school? Because if they don't, you know, the option is either college or prison.
And I'm going to, you know, and I'm, that's a very good question, because this petition that I mentioned earlier, Harold, that we're more than 20, mostly black and brown-led youth organizations representing thousands of youth of color across the country, published today, is calling attention to some of the issues that they are asking society for us to focus on. Divestment from school policing, more counselors instead of cops, more emotional support and health services for students who come to school with baggage that most of us never had to even deal with at their age. And we've got to acknowledge that poverty matters. We have students, over 3,000 students in D.C. that come to public schools every day from homeless shelters. Naturally, those students will not have the same feelings of security. They do not have the same support. And we in schools have got to begin to step up and say, we have to fill in the void. Even when parents are missing, we cannot just use that as a reason for us not supporting students that come to our schools every day. As a public school teacher, I know that teachers fill the void. They do it every day. Many of them are spending their own funds to do that because they know that it's important for them to try to do as much as they can to level the learning field for students. Expanding restorative justice practices. But this student, I'm going to forward you this petition, Harold, because it is quite in depth and it's compelling, because students are basically laying out the framework. What is it that prevents us from wanting to go to schools that say we're here for your safety, but do not, the environment doesn't say that?
Okay.
Where more police are put in schools than counselors. Where more funds are spent on policing schools rather than providing restorative justice or restorative practices and training professional development teachers. So we've got to look at the practices that have been in place and what students are saying, because having conversations with them in many cases will enlighten us as to what it is what they need. Many of them are aware.
Oh, hold on, Liz. I've got to go to the phones. I get your passion and I appreciate it, but I've got to get to the phones. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Thomas calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling, Thomas. What's on your mind?
Hey, yes, good afternoon. Hey, yes, I was calling to chime in. And, you know, everybody has valid points of what some of the problems are, but one of the main problems that I've experienced as a parent is that the social services system needs to be revamped and redirected and structured into how, you know, basically they got laws in place where you can't really discipline your child, you can't correct your child, and if there's no discipline in the home, if there's no respect in the home, how do we expect these kids to go out in public to respect their elders, to respect teachers, police officers, or anybody if they can't be made to respect their own parents in their house?
That's a good question. Dr. Menzies?
Yeah, you bring up a very valid point.
it's a level of respect that is going to have to begin at home. But we were talking about services earlier, and I think it's a community level situation. We're going to have to address it at the community level, have more access to resources in the community itself, so that children, again, once again, have beneficial and bona fide after school programs that do things like teach children how to be respectful. Because you got to remember, that's something that's learned. You know, we had elders and parents and adults in our environment that taught us what it meant to respect other people. If the children aren't learning those basic principles of pro-social behavior, then they're going to be less susceptible and vulnerable to influencing factors that are going to tell them, no, you go out here, you shoot, you kill, you fight, you sell drugs. You know, you consider yourself to be less than a human being. They're going to be more susceptible to those forces if we don't have that tight-knit community for providing positive role models and positive behavior instructions to our children.
Thomas, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Menzi, you brought up a really, really interesting point, and I need to ask you about something that happened on yesterday. And even as we are hoping to get Ward 8 Council Member Trayon White on the line, during his press conference at Ballou, he said that he was looking for the men in the community to step up and be those role models, visible role models, to make sure that the children in that community have safe passage to and from school. Here's my question. Psychologically, what does having those men in the community step up to protect children to and from school when you have in other communities parents that are quote unquote stepping up, just walking their children to school? Is that is there a difference between the two, considering the circumstances?
Yeah, absolutely there is. So one of the main differences, Harold, is that when you have men that are visible and they are there with a purpose to protect and to basically police their own community, regulate their own community, it provides a sense of security to the children and to our youth. And a lot of them are acting out of a deep sense of insecurity. They feel very vulnerable. And it's just like anything that feels vulnerable or that's trapped, whether you're talking about an animal or a person, they will typically lash out of that insecurity. They go into the fight or flight mode. And so with strong men who are there with a very clearly defined purpose are present, and they're there to provide a sense of security, you know, not negative browbeating, but confidence building security. Like, hey man, I see you. How you doing today? All right, let's see what them grades are going to be like. You know, small talk, chat, get to know the kids so the kids get to know you. It provides a sense of stability and security that then decreases the likelihood that the children would need to lash out of a sense of vulnerability.
Do you agree with that, Elizabeth Davis?
Yes, I do. And of course, there are some other elements that I'm going to give more time to the other speakers. That is a part of it.
No, but go ahead and share. He finished his point. Please do share.
Well, I'm just sitting here reflecting on my review of school budgets in D.C. this year, last year, and the year before. And schools such as Ballou, and of course, when we ask, because my thoughts continue to go back to why are these students not in their own school? And we've got to look closely at why. You will hear different points from each one, but when we hear of hundreds of thousands of dollars cut from a school budget such as Ballou, we have to wonder how.
But is that the case in when we're talking about the killing of...
No, why I said that...
Of the 15-year-old student from Ballou. He was getting out of school. It was after school let out, and that is when he was killed. And I think to talk about safety and security, let's for a moment put this Somerset Prep Academy issue aside and just talk about what happened with the Wheeler teenager and the teenager in front of the Idea School a couple of weeks ago, and the other two or so.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are others that we can talk about.
Exactly.
That, but,
exactly.
But you know, and of course, we talked earlier, Harold, about, you know, the presence of police officers in the community, And of course, that would work only if youth in that community perceive the presence of police officer as a safety net, right, as opposed to being a threat. So
right,
there's so many things that factor into the problem, and it's just not one issue.
That's right.
Yeah. I need to take a break. When we come back, we will talk to Trayon White, the Ward 8 council member here in the District of Columbia, Ballou High School, and the incident involving the 15-year-old from Ballou earlier this week, also happening in his ward. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about violent incidents in and around our schools, not only locally, but nationally. We are now joined by D.C.'s Ward 8 Councilmember Trayon White. Councilmember White, thank you for so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Hello, everyone.
Can we talk briefly? I need to hear your reaction to this incident that we heard about on Tuesday afternoon between Ballou students and the students at Somerset Prep Academy. What are you hearing about that incident?
That was an incident that occurred at Somerset, as you saw, most of you saw the video. And it's been several incidents like that between several different schools. I know we've met with several different students from several different schools around incidents similar to this. But that was a small incident and was totally unrelated to the shooting that occurred the day after.
Absolutely, yeah, two different incidents. But please continue.
To, you know, put them both together, but they're both isolated incidents.
But with that said, certainly they one had nothing whatsoever to do with the other, but it does bring up questions about the broader issue of what is happening with our youth in our school and violence as it relates to that issue.
Well, the real issue is not the what's happening in our schools, it's happening in our communities.
Okay.
There's a culture that's shifting, mm-hmm, with violence in our community, and the reality is the meet-up place that people meet up in that age range is school. And so it's happening far too often in schools, but in the communities, we've had, we're averaging a shooting a day, every for the last 2 weeks. In fact, we had someone shot last night. And so it's just not the school, it's the culture of the community that's shifting, and the poverty, with the housing issues, the mental health, the substance abuse. You have to look at all those factors coming into play in this area.
So what, in your opinion, is missing when we hear politicians on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, even locally, talking about the economy improving and buildings going up in the district and unemployment being low? And so why are we still seeing problems in not only your ward, but in Ward 7?
I don't see that narrative. I see that D.C. is growing healthy with having surpluses every year, having a lot of money in the budget. But I don't see it affecting the community because poor are getting poorer. The rich are getting richer. And we see that narrative far too often in our community. And so we have to really look at not just equality anymore, but a conversation around equity. Equity is the answer. Even when we look at our education, we can't build strong communities without strong education and strong economy, you know. And that's what we're really fighting for. When we have schools at the bottom of the totem pole on every aspect. We have one grocery store feeding 70,000 plus people in the community. We don't have the amenities in the community. It's a lot of deficiencies we have, and it's been a divestment when you really want to speak the truth about in D.C. when it comes to youth. Fort Rec has been closed. Hot Rec been closed. Ballou, Number 11 Boys and Girls Club, Kramer. All these recreation centers have been closed over the last 10 years. And we say that D.C. is doing good and the unemployment is going down, but it's not the reality in our community.
So from the perspective of protecting students and teachers and the schools, do we need more police there, or do we need, as you suggested earlier this week, a call for more men to stand up and to be committed? In your opinion, what's the answer?
I don't believe that police is the end-all solution to addressing crime and violence in the community. I believe there's a population that we forget about a lot, and that's the population of people who've been in trouble, had run-ins with the law as returning back to the community. It's hard for them to find a job, hard for them to find employment, but we can utilize those gentlemen and ladies to intervene because they can relate. And some of these are the uncles, the aunts, the fathers of some of these young men that's actively involved in the streets. And so we have to tap into that and get them more involved in the school, in the community. We had that before, but politics got involved and it was removed out of the community. Now we see what we have now. Involved with the gun violence.
Are those wizened mentor type people in the community not stepping up, or why are they not motivated? What's keeping them from providing that input, that intervention?
So to my experience, that we have to build a vehicle for them to use to get involved, because they're not just going to go up to school and just start volunteering. So I think it's a coming upon leadership, myself and the schools. The schools have traditionally been a place where parents and community members didn't feel welcome, as you saw over the years. And so we have to shift on how we think real quick with our school systems. And so, because I get a lot of DMs and Facebook messages, and I want to help. And so I'm actually at the movies right now, mentoring 15 young men right now at the movies, because you know it's we have 83% single parent households in Ward 8. I don't know what the numbers is in Ward 7. I'll guarantee you it's almost similar because of mass incarceration, and we never recovered from the crack epidemic that swept through Washington, D.C.
Let me bring this point, because I think you made a very interesting point where they may not necessarily want to volunteer, that they may not necessarily feel welcome in the schools. You know, Liz Davis, we've seen in affluent communities, and not just here in D.C., but across the country, in affluent communities, we see parents and activists, they own their school system. Even though you have elected board members and superintendents that are administering, but when they want something, they show up, and not just during a crisis. Why isn't that kind of thing apparently not happening in east of the river? Elizabeth, can she hear us? Elizabeth Davis. Oh, she's gone. Okay, we lost Elizabeth. I want
to be able to respond to
that. Well, please, go ahead.
Because I want to say hello to Liz. I know she's been a strong advocate on the front line for education in the city for decades. I want to thank her for her advocacy and her leading the Washington Teachers Union. But I do want to say that there has been a level of disrespect between the school system and the community. And I used to serve on the D.C. State Board of Education. And when parents go up to the school, they act as if they don't know anything. They act like if they're there to cause problems. I had to go to a school today, a charter school, because the father was barred from a school in which he has two daughters. And he's the only the parent for the daughters, and they're trying to bar him from the school. It just happened today, you know. And so we have to have some community respect, some community engagement, because we have a lot of people inside our school systems that don't look like us, that's not from the community, that's making decisions, that don't have the cultural competencies to educate and mold our beautiful black minds, especially in the predominantly African-American communities. And so it's been a disconnect. And then there's been a removal of people who, you know, the teachers that we had traditionally got walked out the building, got fired by the hundreds. And so we have all these new people coming in that don't really have an appetite to teach. Mm. They're there for a little bit. That's why you saw in schools all throughout D.C., teachers was leaving in the middle of the daytime, never returning.
And you know, he raised another issue, Dr. Menzie, that phrase we've been hearing a lot about, cultural competency in schools. Talk to me, Dr. Menzie, about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's so important, because what you have is, as the brother was just saying, is a serious disconnect between the people who are in charge and the people who are being in charge of. And so, like, for example, we're talking about more police in the community. That's only going to work if those police come from that community. You know, there are some cities that practice recruiting police officers from the communities that they're going to be policing. And that gives a sense of connection, right? It gives a certain level of competency about the culture of that environment, of that community. And it ends up being one of our own that's looking out for us. So that cultural competency, man, I spend a lot of time doing cultural competency trainings and helping schools to get up to speed, helping corporations or organizations to get up to speed with that. But it's more than a notion, because what you have are some deeply ingrained biases, some very deep racism, even, you know, some old self-hate stuff is even there. And so you got to work through these layers, and it takes courage to actually do that. But cultural competency, man, I mean, you could go a long way with a culturally competent staff. I mean, because the children, they feel the authenticity of the people that they're working with. If you're scared working with a group of kids, they're going to sense that. If you're authentic and being straight up, they're going to sense that. If you're aware, they're going to sense that. And unfortunately, we don't have enough of that right now.
Council member, do you believe, and this is not about schools, this is about the police, do you believe that the restarting of the old officer-friendly program that was launched this week is a good thing or a bad thing in reference to developing relationships between the police and young children?
I think overall it could be a good thing if done right, but we got to make sure we're hiring the right officers. You can have these programs and going back to officer-friendly or the side-by-side band, but if the officers are not good officers,
right?
Because you just had the story about the former D.C. police who was selling guns in D.C. and got arrested and got charged a year in jail. So you can have the programs all you want, but if you're not hiring people from the community, if you're not doing proper screenings for these officers, then we're back at square one. And the greatest influence on a young person is another young person. And so we have to start developing leaders, really integrating in their society and what they're going through, figure out what's going on with them, talk to them, love on them, because before it escalates to a shooting, there's a conversation, there's a beef, there's a tweet, there's an Instagram message, there's conversations. It's a lot that happens before it escalates to a stabbing or a shooting. And because we're so disconnected, we reactionary. Even the police department, the council member, all of us are reactive because we're not building relationships with those young people before it escalates. So I think the officer-friendly idea is a good idea, or could be a good idea, but it's deeper than that.
Yeah, it is.
That's interesting, because it's been a long time since we've talked about the impact of peer pressure. When we talk about it, we always talk about the negative impact of peer pressure. But I would argue, council member, that positive peer pressure is something we've not had a lot of discussion about. And I think that moving forward, I think that the thing that you just brought up is something that really needs to be discussed and expanded. It could make a positive change in this situation, whether it's in the schools or in the community. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Jeff Menzi, as well as D.C. Ward 8 Council Member Trayon White. Council Member White, good luck to you as you continue to work to provide services and a better quality of life for the citizens in Ward 8. Also, I want to thank Washington Teachers Union President Elizabeth Davis as well for participating in this conversation. That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Friday, May 18th. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Taylor Thomas, Troy Johnson, Millette Green, Bramante Bryant, producer Candace Atkins, engineers Iron Waller, Bobby Adams, and Bobby Patton, I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton. Good night and have a wonderful and safe weekend.